Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 96. Today, the Amateur Traveler goes to Greece.
I got my bags packed and on a roll. I'm heading out there and I'm ready to go. Looking real good in my passport photo.
Oh, no.
15-hour flight, oh, I don't think I'll ever be coming home. You know I love it. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe.
Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. In the first news story, according to a story coming from Reuters, based on a survey of hoteliers across Europe, the best tourists in the world are the Japanese, followed by the Americans and then the Swiss. Japanese tourists stood out for being polite and tidy, securing 35% more votes than the Americans, who came in second. Swiss tourists were commended for being quiet and considerate, unlike Britons, who were judged to be the fifth worst tourists because of rude behavior, noise, and a miserly attitude towards tipping. But despite their faults, hoteliers do look favorably upon British spending habits, voting them the third biggest holiday spenders after the Americans and the Russians. But in case you were wondering, the worst-dressed category, as always, fell to the Americans. In the second story today, July 9th will be the second anniversary of the Amateur Traveler, and in honor of that, I'm going to hold a contest, and this will be a trivia contest. You have, many of you, seen the logo for the Amateur Traveler, and it has on it 8 pictures. And the question is, have you listened long enough? Have you been paying attention? Do you know what those 8 pictures correspond to, where they were taken? Send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com for where you think each of those 8 pictures were taken, and yes, I know they were taken on Earth, and even Europe is not good enough. I'm looking for more specific information. And send that by July 9th, and after that date, I will pick a winner, and the winner of the trivia contest will win both fame and glory, as well as one of the new travel posters that I have on my online store. Links to the contest will be on the show notes at amateurtraveler.com, and also links to the store so you can take a look at the travel posters, and also a larger version of the logo to give you a little better chance of identifying the pictures. I'd like to welcome on the show Alf Meyer. Alf is talking to us from Greece and has come on the show to talk to us about Greece. Alf, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Hi there, everybody.
Now, you are living in Greece, and I think we talked a little bit offline. You're not originally from Greece, though.
No,
I'm not.
Could
you give us a little bit of your background?
Okay, I was born in Düsseldorf, Germany, many years back, but I didn't grow up in Germany. I grew up in Spain, in the northwest of Spain, a place called Galicia.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
The only place in Spain where it rains 300 days a year.
And how did you get to Greece?
Well, that's a long story. One day, my wife came home from work and said, "Hey, Alf, you know something about windmills, don't you?" I said, "Yeah, I built one many years back for an amateur radio repeater." And she said, "Okay, I have a colleague at work who's working for a charity, and they don't have any electricity in this children's village, so why can't you talk to them and see if you can build a windmill?" Well, to cut this long story short, I went to build a windmill, and I didn't want to go home again.
I think I told you that we had a show that was on the Greek Isles just a couple weeks back, and mm-hmm. It's a similar story of a couple that was passing through the Greek Isles, and they were planning on being there for 3 days, and they stayed for 35 years. What is it about Greece that captured you?
Well, see, I don't think that Greece is captivating for everybody. But mm-hmm. if you ask me, it's the weather, it's the way of life. You know, it's a laid-back way of life. The only time when Greeks get hectic is in the summer when the tourists come. And the rest of the time, this is a very relaxing atmosphere, and that really captivated me.
And if you were one of those hectic tourists, which is, of course, what this show often is talking to, let's see, how long do you think it would take if we tried to talk about every interesting thing in Greece?
It would be too long, but let's say you have 2 weeks.
Okay.
You have two options. You will come back at some point and see other things, or you make the traditional tourist roundup.
Okay.
The traditional tourist roundup generally starts, unless you come with a cruise, but generally starts in Athens.
Sure.
Okay, Athens, well, it's a place where you walk over the city center street and you constantly are stumbling over some rock that was history. You know, there are old gates, there are old theaters, there are old temples. They're everywhere, all strewn over the place. Athens alone, if you just want to see the aspects of Athens, you'll probably be there for 5 days.
Certainly, I know that as we've looked at going to Greece, for instance, the Parthenon and the Central Archaeological Museum in Athens, whose name mm-hmm. escapes me, are there things that the guidebook is going to recommend that you're going to say, you know, it's really not worth the time? Instead, you should go to this other place that the tourists don't get to.
Well, with the guidebooks of Athens, if you take even the rough guides, you have a big piece to read.
Sure.
The question there is always, what are you really interested in?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Are you interested in just going, take your snapshots, and may have a good slideshow at home when you return? Or do you have a special interest? If you have a special interest, well, I would say prepare the trip before you even start. Because you are not going to get to every place that you really could see or wanted to see.
As it turns out, I am someone who wants to take a lot of beautiful pictures of Athens. So I'm going to take the Parthenon and...
Then to start with, you want to come in spring.
Okay.
Or late spring, somewhere May, beginning of June. Because Athens at...
Okay.
Your pictures are going to be much more powerful than if you come, let's say, in August when everything is dry. On the other hand, coming in August, you know, even though the city is hot, it has the advantage that most Athenians are on vacation themselves. So even though you won't have any beautiful lawns around the archaeological sites and probably won't find any flowers, you surely will not stumble over many of
them. Okay.
Okay, next thing I would do is get me a battle plan. The Acropolis, for example, already tends to be a problem because the archaeological ministry doesn't like people taking pictures up there. It's done anyway every day, but they have this big sign outside, no picture taking.
Oh, really?
Yes, they do. It's done every day and no problem. You can take pictures by getting permission in written form and so on, but it's a big number. Mostly what happens is tourists take their cameras anyway, and as a friend of mine says it always, if something is forbidden in Greece, it only means that we do it less often.
Okay.
Now, there are parts that you should go after. I would say the Tower of the Winds, which some people always say is a weather station, which is not true. In reality, this was a clock, a water-driven clock. It's been there since 2 centuries before Christ. The clock isn't there anymore, but the tower still is. And it's called the Tower of the Winds because on the outside it has symbols for the predominant winds in Athens. That's an absolute must. Where I have to say that the order is slightly wrong, because mostly you would start at the Tower of the Wind and then walk from there up to the Parthenon. But okay, well, once we've been at the Tower of the Wind, I would go for a little stroll on Plaka, especially down Pandrosso Street, where since antiquity in that general neighborhood was where the market of Athens was. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it isn't much like a market. It's more like little stores, one stuck to another. And a place that I would not miss there, because it's so unusual, it's the poet's sandal shop. This guy is not just called the poet's sandal shop. The guy really is one of Greece's leading poets, but as you can't live from poetry, Besides that, he makes shoes.
Okay.
Okay, and those sandals are quite famous. For example, the Beatles used to order their sandals there. Sophia Loren in several of her old style movies had those sandals. You know, what he does is really sandals the way the Greeks used to wear them 2,000 years ago.
Interesting. Do you get poetry with your sandals?
If you really insist, he sometimes can stop talking about his poetry. In fact, he has photocopies of every review he ever had anywhere in any newspaper worldwide, and he already asks you what's your native language, and he'll give you some.
Interesting.
Okay, Pandroso Street, you can just continue down the same way you came, and you'll end up right in front of Athens Cathedral, which is a big square. The Cathedral Square is a big square where you can also have a good picture-taking occasion. But I wouldn't waste too much time on that, because if you go at the cathedral to the right, in one of those small streets there, you'll find Athens' oldest church, which sounds like something gigantic, but, well, you know, in those days, when those churches were made, and we are talking 5th century, 6th century, these churches weren't big. They were, I don't know, let's say maybe there were 100 Christians in all of Athens, or 110, and well, for them, that was their place of worship. Mm-hmm. So that's about the size of the churches.
Interesting. Okay.
If you continue right down that street, you'll come to Athens' main thoroughfare, you know, the road that goes from Syntagma Square out of the city. And you'll see right in front of you, right there, the old Herodes Stadium. I don't mean the biblical Herodes, I mean Herodes, the Roman ruler, who really built many, many things in and around Athens that are still, let's say, standing, because you can still recognize them as they are.
Uh-huh.
From there, just go to the right, uphill again, and you'll come to his theater, which is very interesting because, besides drama, it's one of the few that are preserved in a, let's say, functional state. I should say sometimes there are even shows there. And what you can see is that even in those days, there were always the seats for people like you and me, which was more or less a slab of rock, and people who were slightly richer, who had a slab of rock built like a chair.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Okay, with that, we have most of the antique things that are in Greece. By this time, if you stop at every piece you find, let's say 10 minutes, by this time, your first day is going to be totally gone. There's nothing left. You'll only drag yourself to the next restaurant, have some dinner, and go to bed.
That actually sounds a lot like me, but I'm hoping okay. that our listeners are better travelers than I am here. But
okay, the next day, you can go over to the more modern Greece, for example, Syntagma Square, or in English, Constitution Square, built around the former king's palace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Greece, after independence, all the European powers started discussing what do we do with these guys. And they decided, well, we just can't, these guys there by their own, they need a king. So they started voting on who this king should be, and they decided it would be King Otto of Bavaria. It had a good part because all the construction he did was actually paid from by his father, so it didn't cost the Greeks anything.
I did not know that.
So, yes, and the thing about the Syntagma Square is the changing of the guard. Right on the palace is the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier from the Independence War against the Turks, and there every hour they have a changing of the guard, which is as colorful as any changing of the guard in front of a royal palace.
Hmm.
You know, the guards wear the traditional uniforms from 1800-something, do their traditional parade steps, just as you would see in London or you would see in Copenhagen.
Hmm.
Around there, you find also the inn quarters of Athens, Monastiraki, Kolonaki, and Lycabethus. Or better say, Lycabethus Hill, which is where all the inn restaurants and inn stores are located.
Okay.
they're right there within 10 minutes walk. As far as picture taking opportunities, unless there is somebody famous there that whose picture you can stumbling over a chair or something you can sell to the tabloids. I was thinking about which one was the American one, but okay. Yes, unless you're after something like that, picture taking is, as in any city, you know, city houses after city house with stores on underneath them. The next day, I would say, go on and try some of the other antiquities, Atticus, Olympion, the Roman market, and the old stadium. You know, one of the myths that are always about the Greek games, and especially about the Olympic games, is that those were the only games that were around. Well, wow. Absolutely not. Every city, or at least every major city, had its games. And some games were even important enough to attract people from other cities. So every major city had or used to have its stadium.
Okay.
I would try that for the next day. If you really plan on taking pictures, it's cutting it a little short. So I would say for the next 2 days. And we're already 4 days into our 2 weeks vacation.
Now, let's say we've got someone who, also like me, is very interested in history. Obviously, you go to Greece because... or part of the attraction, part is, I think, the sun and the beaches, and part of the attraction is for those of us who are drawn by the history of it. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to see some of the highlights of the historical Greece, where would you go? Mm-hmm.
Okay, the next thing is Delphi. It's of absolute importance if you want to even start to understand anything about the Greek culture.
Mm-hmm.
I would recommend to do that in an organized tour, because first, it is not easy to find. And second, even if you were able to find it easily, because it's about 50 miles out of Athens, or mostly over secondary roads.
Okay.
Even if you were to find it, it would be pretty hard for an American to adapt to the Greek driving style. There is no country in Europe that has more road accidents than Greece, and I don't want to scare anybody away. And most of them aren't even due to alcohol. It's just these guys drive like crazy. They all think they're funky.
So driving is a little discouraged, you're saying?
Unless you're really into adventure driving, you know.
driving, okay.
if you're a bandit, you shouldn't have a problem around you.
So you would recommend taking a tour then from Athens, for instance, and getting on a bus and going up to Delphi?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And second, even if you were able to find a place and you're standing there, you wouldn't be sure what you're seeing at every second, you know, because mm-hmm. some things just have been dug up, other things have been restored, other things have been rebuilt. And the people who really know that are the tour guides that go with these organized buses. They really know much more than I could tell you about it right now because, you know, it's their job.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Any tips as you're looking for choosing which of the many, I'm sure, tour companies go up there?
No.
Okay.
No,
fair enough.
No, because I like adventure driving. I always drive myself.
Okay. All right.
Okay, you probably want to go to Thessaloniki next.
Okay.
There's several
ways.
It's
the second largest city in Greece, as I recall.
Right. It's located in the north of Greece. Mm-hmm. And you can get there either by bus, by train, by plane, or even on a ship going island hopping from island to island from Athens to Thessaloniki.
Mm-hmm.
Your options are multiple. What can we see in Thessaloniki? Well, there's old city fortification to start with, and that's what you always see on every postcard of Thessaloniki.
Now, I hear you typing. I really appreciate that you're transcribing all this so that we'll have this later on. That's very helpful.
No, I'm really not. I'm trying to find some of my notes about Thessaloniki.
Rats.
Yes, because I didn't remember the name of the archaeological museum of Thessaloniki, but it's called exactly that, Archaeological Museum of Thessaloniki. And it is one of those must-see things. For example, one of the only complete statues of Augustus, you know, somebody, for somebody who's interested in history, that exists in the world is precisely in this museum.
Oh, really? Interesting. Caesar Augustus we're talking about?
Yes, okay. Himself, the second emperor of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Besides that, it has almost everything of value that's been ever found in the north of Greece in it. The thing is, it's big. It's really big, and you should at least plan a day just for the museum.
Oh, wow, okay.
Probably you can walk through it in 10 minutes or in 15 minutes, but, you know, you probably wouldn't have gotten anything out of it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like this famous tour of the Louvre. Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Louvre. You got 10 minutes time. The Mona Lisa is on the third floor.
Yeah. I think I've done that tour, actually.
Oh, you've done it. Okay. Well, then you know what you're talking about. The rest of the city, well, you know, it's the same as everywhere in Greece. There are hundreds of little towns, little findings, little excavations. And unless you're really into this, unless you're really into the footnotes, you know, there isn't much more that you really want to see up there.
Okay.
Okay, so I think your first week is gone. You haven't even been to the beach yet.
And we've got to get to the beaches, clearly.
Oh, we got to get to the beaches. Okay, good. The good news is there are plenty of beaches everywhere around Athens. Most of Athens is coastline. The bad news about this is most tourists know there's not two, and at least the sand beaches are all full.
So most of the tourists are going to the beaches near Athens?
Near Athens? Well, yes, because most of them are near Athens. But
okay.
But there are some tips. And really, you know, coming to think of it, if I wanted to stop at the beach, I would skip the mainland completely. If I want some, I'm in Athens, I would go to the port of Athena, which happens to be, say, an hour away by bus, and take the next ferry to Andros.
Okay.
Andros Island. And Andros Island, as soon as I get there, jump in a taxi and go to Batsi. And I would do my beach vacation there.
And how far is that? How long is it?
How long? Okay. I think the ferry ride is about 2 hours if you go by a standard ferry. And it's about 1 hour if you take a speedboat, you know, a flying dolphin, as they call it.
Is that a
hydrofoil, yes.
Okay.
Good. And besides that, even though we wanted to talk about the mainland, you know, once you're there, you probably can see one of the best small museums in the world. Let me explain you why I was saying Andros. Most people probably never have heard of it either.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the intent of most of the inhabitants of Andros. Most of them, most of those city clans are very into shipping. These people are not the type of people that sit at the table on Saturday evening with the family council asking whether they should buy a second car. They discuss whether they should buy the third tanker. And these people actually want their peace and quiet. So if a tourist comes to Andros, he'll be surprised how friendly he is received. But on the other side, he'll be also surprised on how little the people of Andros really care about the tourists coming or not.
Okay. It's not the center of the economy in Andros.
No. They rather have it like they always had it. You know, it's been like that for the last 200 years, so let's stay with it. But as I was saying, once you go there, you should go to the art museum in Andros, and you'll find some Picassos, Matisse, and probably some in artists of the time making an exposition there, and almost for a nominal fee. You know, if you're thinking now, okay, they're going to charge me $20 to get in, no, probably not. I haven't been there lately, but the last time I've been there, they wanted something like 500 drachmas, which would be less than 80 cents.
Okay.
And the second thing you can see in Chora is a town that hardly has been changed by the age. You know, it's like these fisher towns used to be always. The only difference is their streets are paved in marble, which wasn't so common for the normal fishers. So once you're there and doing your beach vacation, well, I wouldn't miss Korha in any case.
It sounds like people are moving your furniture in and out of the apartment while we talk, or the house.
Yes, Robin wants to move her furniture, and Robin, they're recording this. Thank you.
Sorry. I didn't know perhaps if I was catching you on the last day that you were living there and you were in the process of moving here or not.
No. Robin sometimes has this thing that she has to move her furniture, and today is the day. Okay, so as I said, if you want to do a beach vacation that's a little different, I would just say, Andros, take a day or two.
Okay.
Have a break, lay on the beach, and, oh, by the way, yes, there are some very good restaurants around there, too.
Okay.
And you don't see them because they have gigantic placards saying good restaurant. You know them because they're there. And if you want fish, you go to the right there to the harbor. Most of those tavernas are also owned by fishermen. And you'll be sure to have the fresh catch of the day and not something that was frozen and came from Thailand.
Okay.
Well, so how far are we with our 2 weeks? I think we're almost through.
We probably are almost through.
So once you return to the mainland, I would say try one or two sites. You can either try Sparta.
Uh-huh.
You can get there by coach. I don't think there's...
And Sparta is in the Peloponnese.
Is in the Peloponnese, right. Because the Peloponnese...
Or southern Greece, for those of you who can't picture the Greece map in your mind.
Right. Okay. Sparta, for the single reason that it's a part of the history. Not mm-hmm. that there's much left of Sparta, but, you know, at least not as much as of Athens,
mm-hmm.
Things happen if you lose a war, you know, they'll kind of let you down a little.
Yeah.
But it's still, you know, if you want to have a feeling for what was going on there, Sparta should be one of your stops.
Okay,
now, for those that are really into adventure, I would take my last days in Meteora. You know, Meteora, those cloisters built up on very steep hills.
Okay. These are the posters we've seen of these churches sitting basically at the top of a rock spire.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. It's in central Greece, and, well, mostly what you get to see is monasteries and churches.
Mm-hmm.
Some monasteries are not accessible, but some others, especially those that don't have many monks anymore, still are. I think there's even one or two monasteries that are open for visitors, so you can stay there overnight.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Meteora, I was saying, because, you know, no trip to Greece would be complete without it. Now, if you really want to learn everything about Meteora, you'll need, let me calculate, like 3 weeks. Oh, we don't have that much vacation.
Okay.
You know, just climbing along those paths and over those hills and mountains, you know, it will take a long time. And let me tell you, it's breathtaking.
Okay.
There's more or less where I would round up my trip.
All right. Is there any other final recommendations you'd have for us in terms of while we're in Greece and all of these places we've been, anything else that we need to make a full Greece experience as much as we can pack into 2 weeks?
Okay, good. Then I would say if you want the full Greek experience, I would scrap everything we talked about before and go to... Go to a little fishing village, you know, real village that doesn't even have a hotel, and live in a local pension, or sometimes if they have a room or two on top of the mayor's offices or city hall, and just stay there for 2 weeks. Live with the people and you'll be amazed.
And do you have a favorite little fishing village that I've never heard of?
Olymbos on Karpathos.
Well, one more time.
Olymbos.
It's a B. Okay.
Yes. On Karpathos.
On Karpathos. Oh, on Karpathos. Okay. Got it.
On Karpathos.
On the island
of
Karpathos.
Okay. It's the most traditional village. that still exists in Greece. You know, people don't wear their same dresses, the traditional clothes there, because the tourists are coming, they wear them because they wear them. The social structure is about the same as it used to be 7 or 8 centuries ago in this village. With one difference, most of the people from Olymbos are living in Baltimore nowadays and are working there and only come back in the summer.
All right.
So you wouldn't even have a problem trying to be understood around there.
Oh, okay. All right. Interesting.
I would say, you know, if you want to experience Greece as is, I would say, hey, forget the whole rest. Just get a ticket from Athens to Karpathos. From Karpathos, jump in the next taxi and have him drive you up to Olymbos. Or okay. if you wanted a little more adventurous, you can go to Karpathos Harbor and take the boat that goes there every day.
Well, I thank you so much for being on the show, Alf. This has been great. For those of us who haven't been to Greece yet, you've given us at least a couple options here to think about.
See, Greece isn't a thing that you can do in 2 weeks.
Sure. Well, it sounds like there's some danger that whenever you go to Greece, you may stay for the rest of your life. So I'm a little worried about that.
Well, yes, I understand. Okay, then.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. See you later.
Bye-bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. It did pose some interesting issues as far as editing, since I couldn't edit out all of the background noise. People moving furniture is a new one for me. But I think there's some really great information in there, and I was so glad to have Alf on the show. I just have one internet resource for you today, and that is another podcast. It's the French École podcast. It is a very popular podcast for learning French. I have been listening to this podcast in preparation for my trip in July to Germany, Switzerland, France, and Italy. And the problem I have with that trip is that although I have studied German, French, and Italian, I'm rusty on all of them, and I'm trying to brush up on all three at the same time. And this has probably been the podcast that I found the most useful. And so I'll put links to that in the show notes, the French École podcast. It is a wonderful series of 27 episodes at the time I'm recording this, including PDF files that you can look in terms of vocabulary words and such that go with each lesson. So wonderful job with that, and I think you'll enjoy that if you're trying to brush up or learn French. In news from community, I got a great letter from Thomas this week that I think has a new slogan for the amateur traveler. Let me read you part of Thomas's letter. I wanted to express my appreciation to you for putting together your podcast. It is surely tedious at times. Now, I'm hoping Thomas means it must be tedious to put together the podcast, which it is, rather than the podcast itself, but Amanda, the stay-at-home mom who made the suggestion regarding trip costs, did echo my thoughts. I have been fortunate enough to travel more than most folks, and it has largely been a result of frugal planning. Thus, I am always interested in someone's creative ideas at travel. It would seem to be more sexy to just be able to travel whenever you wish, but that goal is still out of reach for me anyway. I think the Year in Europe show has been my favorite so far at Foster's Dreams, and your trip to Tanzania was outstanding as well. I have thought in depth and done some basic planning for a Tanzania trip for more than 7 years. I guess your show is really just, quote, water for the thirsty traveler. Thanks, Thomas. I like that. That might be the new motto for the show, water for the thirsty traveler. Thanks for writing. I also got a letter from Jason, who wondered about one of the things I had said in the show about Andalusia. Jason wrote, Chris, another great show. It was just about 6 weeks too late for me. Sorry, Jason. I took a transatlantic cruise in May that stopped in the Bahamas, Tenerife, and the Canary Islands, Cadiz, and Gibraltar before ending in Barcelona. Beautiful trip. We decided to spend our day in Cadiz instead of taking the cruise line bus to Sevilla, but it's a wonderful area. Gibraltar was my favorite spot just because I have an interest in the age of sail and the history of the British Navy there is amazing. I wanted to ask you about something you said in the podcast about Sevilla being the location that ships from the New World came and went through. I think they actually came and went through Cadiz, seeing that Sevilla is landlocked, but I'm sure all that money went immediately from Cadiz to Sevilla. Thanks for all the hard work, Jason. Jason, you are both correct and incorrect. The second voyage of Columbus, for instance, did sail from Cadiz, but Sevilla does have a port, and I will put a link to prove it in the show notes to the port of Sevilla, which includes a history of the port of Sevilla. And one of the things that it says in here is Sevilla idea had two clear advantages when it came to formalizing the trade monopoly. The first was its magnificent geographical inland position. It's up a river, as it turns out, from the coast, as the terminal of a waterway, which made any military attempts impossible. Trade was somewhat wary of Cadiz, even though it was apparently better suited to capture colonial traffic, because it is on the coast. Yet events like the English assaults in 1587 and 1596 showed that such doubts were well-founded. So basically, although it was further inland up the river, it was more defensible, and therefore that's where most of the trade happened. And before I become too insufferably pleased with myself, it probably is a good idea at this point to end the show. Thanks for all of the letters. For those of you who also would like to send me feedback, send email to host@amateurtraveler.com. Don't forget the contest, which is starting, and we'll wrap up by July 9th, so send in your entries. I don't suspect that anyone will get all 8 correct, so don't be afraid if you don't know all of them. For many, many other ways to contact me, check out amateurtraveler.com/contact. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
Got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be heading home, but maybe not today.
The best and the brightest, served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Podshow and Limelight.